talk tomorrow evening at the same time, and it's about Ape Man, fact or fiction. The meetings have been convened by the Christians from the Gospel Hall in South Street. They welcome you, as I do, and they would welcome you to their Sunday evening services at 6:30 every Sunday, God willing. Now, just as I did on Monday night, I want to dispel any false notion that you might have. I feel there's a danger that you look at the man at the front and you think that he's got all of the answers. Let me say this, I haven't got all of the answers. Perhaps I've just got a fraction of the answers. But I believe passionately in the truth that, as the Bible states, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And if that is so, if you and I are the product that come from the very hand of God, the offspring of God, then we're going to face him one day. But of course, man has come up with the theory of evolution. And on Monday, we tried to present some of the evidence that would suggest that in the beginning, God created. So tonight's subject is fossils and the flood. But just before we move on to show the slides, someone has asked if I have anything in writing. Well, just over a year ago, I published this publication. It's called A Case for Creation. It's 48 pages in length. It's a combination of text and graphics, so a lot of the information I'm regurgitating tonight you'll find in this book, which will be on sale tomorrow night at the reasonable price at £2.50. £2.50, very reasonable. So if you're interested, tomorrow night it will be available. I suppose that's an incentive to get you back here tomorrow. And if you could have the right money, because Adrian hasn't got any change. Okay? And so we'll fire away. Now, for those who missed out on the spectacular offer on Monday night, just let me repeat it. There might be some here tonight and you believe strongly in the theory of evolution. Well, that's a tremendous offer, isn't it? Someone in America, Dr. Kent Hovind, and there's his website, Dr. Dino, he's offering $250,000 to anyone who can give scientific, empirical evidence for evolution. It was originally $10,000, and that offer had been available since 1990, but of course he's increased it now. In 1999, I got a personal letter from him on the 13th of December. $250,000. Easy money if evolution is a fact. I don't think he'll get any takers somehow. Now, it was this man, as we said on Monday, who started the evolutionary thinking process, well, made it popular in the minds of men, when he published his book in 1859, The Origin of Species. Charles Darwin needed something if evolution could take place, and it was millions of years. And I'd like you to meet the man who gave Charles Darwin the millions of years that he needed. They called him Sir Charles Lyell, said to be the father of modern geology. Lyell came up with a theory of uniformitarianism. That's a very long word, but you can understand the word uniform. And all it means is that uniformitarianism would suggest that the sedimentary rock layers that we have around the world, and 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered in sedimentary rock, sandstone, shale, gritstone, and the like, they say that it is laid down at a uniform rate. It's laid down very, very slowly. And I have read somewhere that they reckon that the rate was about 1 foot every 1,000 years. So a foot of sedimentary rock, such as limestone, laid down a foot every 1,000 years. Now, if you've never been to the northeast of England, I would suggest that you come, because we have a lovely coastline, lovely beaches. And if you'd come to the town where I meet with a group of Christians, South Shields, I could take you to the beaches, and I could take you to the cliffs, limestone cliffs. The cliffs tower 80 feet above sea level. and they rise up right to the top of the Lees, buff laminated limestone, 80 feet. Now, using the theory of uniformitarianism, they would tell me that the limestone there was laid down very, very slowly, a foot for 1,000 years. Now, even the children here tonight should be able to tell me how long, using the theory of uniformitarianism, would it take to lay down the 80-foot cliffs that we find from sand level to the top. It would be 80,000 years. So we see that in that little section at South Shields, 80,000 years. The theory of uniformitarianism. Here is something called the geological column. Because what they have done, they have mapped out the sedimentary layers into these particular forms here. Precambrian, Cambrian. If there's any child can remember that at the end, I'm going to ask a question. You might get a lollipop off me. Now, we travel up, and there's a layer you've all heard of, Jurassic, said to be the age of the dinosaurs. Now, in the sedimentary rock, going from Cambrian to Pleistocene, we will find fossils. And they would suggest that the fossil record shows the development of simple life forms, reptiles, mammals, ape man, and eventually modern man in the Pleistocene period. Now, I can see one fault on this just by my simple eye. Precambrian, that is wrong. You do not find jellyfish fossils in Precambrian rocks. But what we do find in this layer here, the Cambrian layer, we find what the geologists called the explosion of life. Life suddenly appears in this particular layer, fully formed and fully developed. So we're going to come back to that layer at the bottom. I hope you can remember it for your lollipop children. How do we get fossils? I sat in a lesson at a junior school, and they suggested that an animal came down to a creek to drink water. He died there, and the silt built up around him, and ever so slowly, the creature was fossilized. That is an actual fossil from the Stuttgart Museum in Germany. It is a mother ichthyosaur, giving birth. It's a very poor slide, but we know it was a female because coming from the birth canal, there is the baby ichthyosaur. So this creature was fossilized in the very act of giving birth. And fossils like this tell us, well, Dr. Carl Whelan says this, such well-preserved features could not have come from mother and baby lying on the ocean floor through countless ages of slow processes. In other words, Dr. Whelan is saying that creature was covered by sediment and covered by sediment not slowly but quickly and locked into the sedimentary rock layers. We're going to see three things from the fossil record. We're going to see rapid burial. Creatures and trees buried rapidly. We're going to see no intermediate forms. And we're going to see, thirdly, no change in creatures. For example, the coelacanth, a fish. I just want to beam in on this particular word here, intermediate. The fossil record shows no intermediate forms. What does the word intermediate mean? Well, here's a cartoon from the Daily Telegraph in 1995 which will convey the meaning of an intermediate form. Britain was in dispute with Spain about fishing rights around our country. And this man here, Luis Atienza, he was Spain's agriculture and fisheries minister at the time. So the Daily Telegraph did a skit of him. They had it the other way around. They had him turning into the fish. Now what's number one? A fish. What's number five? A man. 2, 3, and 4 are what we call the in-between stages, the intermediate stages through which the fish, this hypothetical case, would have to pass through before it could become a man. No intermediate forms. Now that might come as a shock to some here tonight. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll ask into the witness box a senior paleontologist from the British Museum of Natural History. They call him Dr. Colin Patterson. Now, a paleontologist is just a man who studies the rocks and the fossils. He wrote a book in 1978, and it was called Evolution, a simple title, Evolution. And in the book, Dr. Patterson invited comments from his readers. One man in New York, a man called Luther Sunderland, wrote to Dr. Patterson and asked him, he says, Dr. Patterson, I've read your book all about evolution. I've read it from cover to cover. And I find this. You have not included in your book any example of an actual transitional or an intermediate form, the in-between stages. You've written a book on evolution, but there are no intermediate stages given in your book. Could you please tell me why? Well, Dr. Patterson wrote, and it's documented. He says, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions, intermediate stages, in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. It begs the question, doesn't it? If Dr. Patterson, a senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, if he didn't include them in his book because he didn't know of any, then why is he clinging on to the theory of evolution? Dr. Patterson was a very, very honest man. He sent shockwaves through his particular scientific community by that statement. But please, this man is not a one-off. He's not a maverick. He's not a loose cannon. Let's travel across the Atlantic and let's meet another man, a firm evolutionist. He's called Niles Eldridge. And he gave a lecture to the American Museum of Natural History in 1978. And he says this, the smooth transition from one form of life to another, which is implied in the theory, is not borne out by the facts. The search for missing links between various living creatures like humans and apes is probably fruitless because they never existed as distinct transitional forms. No one has ever yet found any evidence of such transitional creatures. Geologists have found rock layers of all divisions of the last 500 million years, and no transitional forms were contained in them. If it is not the fossil record which is incomplete, it must be the theory. So another paleontologist, a high-ranking paleontologist from across the Atlantic in America, is saying that. I just want to go back to the previous slide because I missed off something that I think is very important. If I was to ask you what's the most important word in that statement, I just wonder what you would say. I'll tell you what I think is the most important word. It is that, the word living. If I knew of any intermediate stages, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. Is it not reasonable that if evolution is going on today, and they tell us that fish turned into amphibians, and amphibians turned into reptiles, and reptiles turned into birds, and reptiles turned into mammals, why don't we see the intermediate stages living today? You'd think there would be some examples around the world. And yet it's very, very conformed to a particular pattern, is it not? Well, you're saying these two men, they're loose cannons again. Not quite. Because here's another geologist, Dr. David Kitts, Professor David Kitts. Despite the bright promise that paleontology That is, the study of fossils provides a means of seeing evolution. It has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. So the fossils do not give us the necessary in-between stages that are vital for evolution if it is to be accepted as a reasonable hypothesis. Dr. Duane Gish, in his book, The Challenge of the Fossil Record, he says, one may ask, just why then is Professor Kitts an evolutionist? Whatever else motivates Kitts to accept evolution, it appears obvious that he is an evolutionist not because of the fossil record, but in spite of the fossil record. So, let's bring somebody else into the witness box. And here we have someone called Stephen Stanley, quoted in Michael Denton. Michael Denton, by the way, is an Australian molecular biologist and a medical doctor too. And he throws out the theory of Darwin. He'll have nothing to do with it all. He thinks it's ridiculous. And he quotes Stephen Stanley, the known fossil record fails to document a single example of gradual evolution accomplishing a major morphologic transition, and hence offers no evidence that the gradualist model can be valid. So somebody else who's saying that the fossil record does not suggest evolution with its intermediate forms. Well, this is what Denton says about evolution, down at the bottom. Don't forget, he's not an idiot, he's a molecular biologist, a medical doctor. Ultimately, the Darwinian theory of evolution is no more or less than the great cosmogenic myth of the 20th century. It is a fairy tale, he says. Evolution is a fairy tale. Well, let's move on, because remember the slide about Charles Darwin? When Charles Darwin published his book, The Origin of Species, he had a chapter given over to difficulties with his work. And this is what he writes. Intermediate links, the in-between stages, geology, the fossils, the rocks, assuredly do not reveal any such finely graduated organic change. And this is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. But you know what Darwin lived in hope of? He said, 100 years after my death, the fossil records in the museums around the world will be so full that we'll have all of the intermediate stages that we need to document the transition from single cells to complex life, fish to amphibians, amphibians to reptiles. But we're 100 years on. Dr. Colin Patterson, Professor Kitts, Eldridge, they're all saying this. The fossils do not give the intermediate stages. Luther Sunderland, the man who wrote to Colin Patterson, he also had interviews with 5 eminent scientists who believed in evolution. He interviewed Patterson, Eldridge from New York, David Rout from Chicago, Pilbeam from Boston, and Donald Fisher from the Natural History Museum in New York. And this is what he found from his interviews. None of the 5 museum officials could offer a single example, just one example, of a transitional series of fossilized organisms that would document the transformation from one basically different type to another. Now these men are right at the head of the evolutionary movement, right up there when it comes to fossils, and yet they could not give this inquiring man, Sunderland, they couldn't give him one example of a transitional form. Let's go back to a statement that Sunderland managed to get out from Colin Patterson. Now this is very, very honest. Dr. Patterson spoke most freely about the absence of transitional forms. If you ask what is the evidence for continuity, you'd have to say there isn't any in the fossils of animals and man. The connection between them is in the mind. So where does evolution take place? It is all in the mind of man. Let's quote now from 1 or 2 books on evolution. They tell me that fish turned into amphibians. I want to beam in on this particular phrase here. It's Encyclopedia of Reptiles and Amphibians, 1986. It's about the transition from fish to amphibians. Although this transition doubtless occurred over a period of millions of years, there is no known fossil record of these stages. Now I tell you which word in that sentence I find alarming. It is that word there. Doubtless. In other words, I haven't got any doubt at all that fish turned into amphibians. But when it comes to evidence, there is no known fossil record of these stages. Do you know, if I was to take that to the Old Bailey and to try it in a court of law, it wouldn't get to the hearing stage. They would boot it out and they would say, no evidence, no evidence. But let's move on. They tell us that reptiles turned into birds. The origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which this remarkable change from reptile to bird took place. Now, you just think about that sentence. Think about it. They tell us that reptiles turned into birds. But there's no fossil evidence. So how do they know that reptiles turned into birds? I'll tell you what it is. If you look at the legs of a hen, you'll see scales. And so they say, ah, there's the scales of the reptile that make the reptile turn into the bird. But what about the duck-billed platypus? It's got a beak, hasn't it? Has it come from the birds? Has it come from the ducks? And let's move on. Amphibians to reptiles. And we're quoting from the books written by evolutionists. Unfortunately, not a single specimen of an appropriate reptilian ancestor is known prior to the appearance of true reptiles. In other words, when you find reptiles in the fossils, they are reptiles. They are not the in-between stages between the two of them. The reptiles arose from amphibians of some kind. Here we go again, the same sort of reasoning. But the details of their early history are not clearly understood, and current ideas about them are in the state of flux. 1986. Now someone might be saying, what about the horse? Professor Othniel Marsh of Yale, one of America's greatest paleontologists, set out to confirm Darwin's theory of evolution by working out the evolution of the horse. He collected a magnificent set of American fossil horses and he published a paper in 1874 tracing the development from a small three-toed animal the size of a fox. Darwin thought that Marsh's fossil sequence of little Eohippus, dawn horse, to modern horse was the best evolutionary demonstration anyone had produced in the 15 years since his book, The Origin of Species, was published. So Charles Darwin was rubbing his hands with glee. Here is the proof, a lovely sequence from dawn horse to modern horse in the fossil record. Well, Marsh's horse evolution became enshrined in every biology textbook, and a grand fossil exhibition was staged at the American Museum of Natural History. When I was 11, it was long before they had televisions in school. And we had a very strict teacher. He was called Pop Hodgson. He was a very explosive character. He would give you the cane for the least thing. I got the cane 14 times that year. But there was one boy in my class, John Gibbons, he got it 77 times that year. So you'll understand that Pop was a vicious teacher. And every Friday, I can remember a program that we had on the radio, not the television. But Pop used to make us look at a loudspeaker in the corner of the room. I found it no effort to look at that loudspeaker. It was a television screen to me, because what was coming out of it fixed me. It just grabbed me. And I can tell you the title of the program today, even though it's about 40 years on. It was called How Things Began. Now, there might be some people in the audience tonight, and you're about the same age as me, and you sat through those programs. How Things Began. It gripped me. And I can remember one of the programs, it was about the evolution of the horse. And I just wonder if it was this particular sequence they were broadcasting to the thousands of 11-year-olds in the nation of Britain. Well, come with me, because you and I were going to make an imaginary journey across the Atlantic right now. I'm going to take you to the American Museum of Natural History. You're going to come with me. We're going to go up the steps. We're going to go in through the doors, and we're just, oh look, there's one of the wardens. Excuse me, sir. But we've got a party from Perth here, and we would like to see Professor Marsh's horse sequence that demonstrates evolution. He scratches his head and says, Marsh's horse sequence. Just a minute, I'll go and get the curator. So off he goes to get the curator, and you repeat your request. We've travelled across the Atlantic. We want to see Marsh's horse sequence of fossils. Oh, he says, come with me. And he takes you down to the basement. And he unlocks a door that the public can't go through. And he blows away the cobwebs. And he takes you through to all of the specimens. And he points you to a pile in the corner. He says, there it is. It is no longer an exhibit. It is out of date. Here is a quotation from the Encyclopedia of Evolution by Richard Milner. The exhibit is now hidden from public view as an outdated embarrassment. Almost a century later, paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson re-examined horse evolution and concluded, this is sad, that generations of students had been misled. I just wonder if it was Marsh's sequence that was being broadcast those Fridays. Generations of students misled. I believe it was a poison that was coming out of those loudspeakers, poisoning and subtly influencing the minds of children 10 and 11 years of age, robbing from them the very notion that there's a God who created all things, and helping them to latch on to is what in the end of the day is nothing but a lie. Now please, there is another fossil horse sequence out today. But it is not without problems, and I just wonder how long that before that exhibit finds its way into the basement. Anybody here able to tell me the bird that the evolutionist says demonstrates the evolution from reptiles to birds? Archaeopteryx. And here is a picture of Archaeopteryx. This is a photocopy from a book in the school library where I worked. That is Archaeopteryx. It was found in southern Germany. The bird's got teeth and it's got claws on its wings, and so they suggest it's an intermediate form. Now notice what it says. I've not made this up. This is a photocopy from the book in that library. The skeleton of Archaeopteryx, the first bird, is shown as it was found in the fine-grained limestones of Solnhofen in southern Germany. So what's this book saying? Archaeopteryx is the first bird. And any child picking that book up, taking it home, he reads that and he accepts it as fact. They do not suggest it, they're saying categorically it is the first bird. It is not the first bird. We can say that categorically. Because in Nature magazine, 1986, this was the title of an article, Fossil Bird Shakes the Evolutionary Hypothesis. Fossils of modern type birds have been found in rocks which, according to evolutionists' own dating system, are 75 million years older than Archaea. So Archaeopteryx isn't the first bird. And I ask you, will the headmaster at that school, will he remove that book from the shelf? Because it is misinformation, it is a lie, and it will affect, it will colour the thinking of any child who picks that book up. You see, it takes place ever so subtly and ever so slowly. Well, let's go back now to concentrate on rapid burial. Fossils demand rapid burial. I'll give you some examples. You know what a clam is, don't you? Two shells together. When a clam dies, the shells spring open, dead. Clams, there are clam layers several feet thick found in various parts of the world, ranging from the Paluxy River to Pryor's Closed Open Cast Site in County Durham. They contain millions of tightly closed clams, telling us that they were buried rapidly. Now, you can't see in the light, but here is a fossilised clam. That is from County Durham, quite close to where I live. I went to an open cast site and I was asking the manager, any chance of any fossils? He took me to a site, he said, you can have as many as you want. He said, we found a layer of these clams. And he says, you could put your hand into the shale and you could scoop them out in the hundreds. And every clam that I found, and there were millions of them, there we are, fossilized, open, fossilized, closed. Millions of them. And layers that are feet thick. So what does that tell us? They didn't die. They didn't die naturally. They were covered by sediment in water, and they were locked into that silt layer, ready to become part of the sedimentary layers. Now, near a home, right on your own doorstep in Scotland here. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but you have what we call old red sandstone. Now, I noticed that a lot of your buildings in Perth are made of red sandstone. I just don't know if it's the same red sandstone that we're going to talk about. Hugh Miller, geologist, found abundant aquatic fauna embedded. The animals in disturbed positions, strewed thick with the remains, which exhibit unequivocally the marks of violent death. The figures are contorted, contracted, curved. The tail in many instances bent round to the head. The fins are spread to the full. As fish, they die in convulsions. What agency of destruction could have accounted for innumerable existences of an area perhaps 10,000 square miles in extent being annihilated at once? This is no riverbed. 10,000 square miles of northern Scotland, old red sandstone. And wherever you go in it, you will find the evidence of fish dying violent deaths. Now, I ask you, what agency could wipe out so many fish and lock them into the sedimentary rock layers over such a vast area, 10,000 square miles? Now, I know what you're going to say. The fish have died, and they've all gone down to the bottom, and they've been covered by silt. We'll show how that is not a reasonable hypothesis in a moment. Well, let's go to California. The Miocene Shales. 4 square mile area. 1 billion fish died and fossilized. Let's go to Santana Formation of Brazil. Fish whose gills and muscles are so perfectly preserved that geologists believe they were fossilized within 5 hours of death. David Martel, he called it the Medusa effect after the creature of Greek mythology who could turn people to stone instantly with a stare. So they were buried instantly. Let's leave Brazil. Let's go to South Africa. Africa, the Karoo supergroup. It has been estimated by Robert Broom to contain the fossils of 800 billion vertebrate animals. That is, animals with backbones. If it said 800, I would have been impressed. If it said 800,000, I would have been impressed. 800 million, I would have been impressed. But here is an area that contains the fossil remains of 800 billion vertebrate animals. I ask you, what mechanism could destroy so much wildlife and form it into one of the sedimentary layers that we find in the world? Let's go back to, is it Wyoming? Colorado, Utah, Wyoming. In 1994, Michael Brett Sermon said of the newly discovered Wyoming site, it was just crawling with bones. This is what Dr. Duane Gish says about the fossils. The fossil record, rather than being a record of transformation, change, one creature into another, it is a record of mass destruction, death and burial by water and its contained sediments. Whether or not the earth is 10,000, 10 million or even 10 billion years old, the fossil record does not support the general theory of evolution. And here's quite a find. 30 tons of Permian limestone from Texas. And we find that Arthur Cooper, he extracted 3 million individual invertebrate fossils, almost all of which are exquisitely preserved. 30 tons. 3 million individual fossils. We could go back to Wyoming. Let's go to Germany. Let's go to the fossil graveyard in the Eocene lignite deposits in Germany. More than 6,000 remains of vertebrate animals and a great number of insects, mollusks and plants were found in these deposits. The compressed remains of soft tissue of many of these animals show details of cellular structure. So again, a mass burial of creatures. Do you notice what we're doing? We've been to Wyoming, we've been to Brazil, we've been to Scotland. We are now in Germany. I could take it to the Gobi Desert with this slide, but time is pressing on. Let's go to Australia now and see if you can tell me what this is. It's not a very good picture, but the title should give you a clue. Too soft to fossilize. Anybody any ideas? A jellyfish. This man, by the way, is called Dr. Andrew Snelling, a doctor of geology. He believes the Bible from cover to cover. He'll have none of the nonsense of evolution. And he says this on an audio tape that I've got of him. In 1946, a survey was carried out in the South Australian Geological Survey team in the Flinders Ranges. Hundreds upon hundreds of these jellyfish fossils were found in a sandstone layer that could be traced over several hundred square miles of outback Australia. In the middle of Australia, outback Australia, fossilized jellyfish. Based upon the evidence of what he, the surveyor, saw about this particular fossil, he had to admit that all of these fossils formed in less than a day. You ever seen a jellyfish on the beach? And you go back the next day, you go back in the afternoon, if the tide hasn't taken it, it comes out and it melts and very slowly disintegrates. Hundreds of square miles of outback Australia, fossilized jellyfish. Now what is it that could, what is the mechanism that could destroy so many and also lock them in such finely detailed structures? What is it? Now look at this. There is a whale. A fossilized whale. They were slicing through a quarry in California in 1976. And all of a sudden, there appeared, in the quarry face, there appeared this. An 80-foot baleen whale. Fossilized, standing on its tail. Andrew Snelling has been back to this place. And his investigation suggests that it was actually fossilized horizontal, but earth movements have turned it to the vertical. So I don't know what it would be from belly to blowhole. Let's put the whale on its tummy. Should we say 12 feet? Now, can you see how the theory of uniformitarianism is impossible when it comes to the fossilization of this whale? Remember what they said? A foot for 1,000 years. A foot for 1,000 years. Well, the first foot of the whale, 1,000 years to be fossilized. Now tell me, Does the whale hang around for another 11,000 years to be fossilized? Never. For that creature to find itself locked into the sedimentary layers, it had to be covered quickly. It had to be covered instantly. This is not a one-off. Because we could go to Canada. I'll give you three examples in Canada. Do you see what we're doing? We're traveling around the world and we're finding a record of death. Whale fossils, 400 feet above sea level. Ontario, Vermont, 500 feet. Another fossilized whale, 600 feet above sea level. As Velikovsky observes, although whales occasionally enter the mouth of the St. Lawrence River, they do not usually climb the surrounding hills. Well, let's go to India. Let's go to the Siwalik Hills. 3,000 feet high, several hundred miles long, foothills of the Himalayas. The Siwalik Hills contain extraordinary rich beds crammed with fossils. Hundreds of feet of sediment packed, jumbled with bones of scores of extinct species. Many of these creatures were remarkable. A tortoise, 20 feet long. An elephant with tusks, 14 feet long and 3 feet in circumference. Hundreds of miles and hundreds of feet thick. A real jumble of bones and creatures that have suddenly found themselves 3,000 feet above sea level. And here's a slide that we just composed before we came, because I thought that this was an interesting one. From Mongolia, is it? 1971. Two dinosaurs fossilized. One was on the back of the other attacking it. So two dinosaurs, one trying to make a meal of the other one, and all of a sudden he finds himself fossilized, locked into the fossil record, there to be dug up in 1971. Now, how could the uniformitarianism mechanism, how could it possibly cover two creatures like that? They would rot. But here they are, covered in an instant by water and its contained sediments. This is my favourite slide. It is from the old red sandstone of Scotland. You should be proud of this. It's a Scottish fossil. It's a real fossil. This is not made up. I don't know if you can see it. We'll move it. Move it up a bit higher. See what it is, can't you? It's a big fish swallowing a minnow, a little fish. There's the eye of the big fish. There's the mouth of the big fish. And there's the tail of the little fish. This is a real fossil. And there are several examples in the world of this sort of thing. How could this happen? Can I take you back before this happened? Big fish swimming through the North Sea, feeling hungry, dinner time, small fry ahead, opens up his mouth, swims towards it, grabs it, but before he can get it down its gullet, it is covered with sediment and locked into the sedimentary rock layers to be dug up at a later date. Now, what are you saying? Ian, no, you're wrong. That fish died and it fell to the bottom and it was covered by sediment. I said we'd come back to that, did I not? And here we are. They carried out experiments in a marsh, in a part of America, in a warm southern marsh. And what they did, they took fish, freshly killed fish, and they placed their bodies in wire cages and they lowered them to the bottom of the muddy lake in conditions that they suggested would lead to shale, where fish have been found. They returned in 6.5 days to find that all of the flesh had decayed from the fish and even the bones had been disconnected. On the basis of their experiment, we can say that some major catastrophe caught and buried large numbers of fish quickly. All over the earth. Are we seeing fossils forming today? Dr. Sunderland asked one of the five men. He asked him that question. Dr. Fisher, do you know of any examples today where fish are being fossilized on the bottom of the sea floor? Oh, he says, I can't give you any specific examples, but I'm sure that they're finding them on the sea floor today. When the skeletons fall to the sea floor, I'm sure that a certain percentage of those that are being covered with sediment. Dr. Fisher, have you got any first-hand knowledge? Have you any concrete knowledge of that happening? His reply was in the negative. Did I see it? No, I haven't seen it. No, neither had he heard of any. So Sunderland said to him, "See, Dr. Fisher, this is what we're trying to sift out, the conjecture from the facts. The conjecture is that these thick layers of fish fossils were formed over millions of years as sediments covered the dead fish, but we don't find them on the bottom of any ocean, sea or and is consumed." So here is a paleontologist who has to admit he doesn't know of anywhere where they're forming today. I'll give you another example of how things were buried in sediment quickly. That is called a polystrate tree. You know the word poly? Polygon, many-sided. Poly just means many. Strata, straight. Trees that go through several layers of strata. Several layers of rock. This is from Tennessee. That's a coal seam. That's limestone. Foot for 1,000 years. Foot for 1,000 years. Foot for 1,000 years. Impossible, isn't it? You see, a tree wouldn't hang around that long for 1,000 years. In the first 1,000 years, the rest of the tree would have rotted away. That's not a one-off. Here we go to Lancashire. They found a tree 38 feet high, still standing in its living position. Sedimentation must therefore have been fast enough to bury the tree. 38 feet of tree buried in situ, covered with sediment, covered by water. But then we go to New York State and we find this. A whole forest of in situ Devonian trees, 40 feet high. How do you cover a forest 40 feet high with sediment? What mechanism could do that? The Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution. The very first time they appear, it's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. Well, we'll have to move on. I'm going to very soon give out an award and a lollipop to somebody. There's a creature that we find in the Cambrian layer quite regularly. It's called a nautiloid. Now the reason I've got an eye up there is because the creature, rather like an octopus, but found in an ice cream, an inverted ice cream cone, it's the eye of the nautiloid is very, very similar to a human eye. Where do we find it? We find it in the Cambrian layer. The first layer that would have this appearance of multi-life. So, do you know how complex the human eye is? I'll tell you how complex your eye is. You have a retina on the back of your eye, it's the size of a postage stamp. It has 137 million light-sensitive receptor cells. They have carried out calculations that each cell performs 10,000 million calculations per second. Now grasp that. 137 million light-sensitive receptor cells, and each cell performing 10,000 million calculations per second. That is how complex the eye is. Don't take it for granted, but the eye of the nautiloid is almost identical to the eye of the human. And there it appears, in the layer in which we find the sudden appearance of life. Where are the predecessors? Where are the eyes that led up to this complex eye? In one of the creationist magazines that I have read in the past, a number of scientists were asked to give the reason why they cannot accept evolution. And one of the men was called Dr. Kurt Wise, himself a paleontologist. He said, "I cannot accept evolution, and I would use a little creature to show that evolution is not possible." and there's the creature. It's called a trilobite. Now, I got a trilobite here. I'll just show you it. This one's about 8 centimetres long. They can come up to 30 centimetres, or the size of your little fingernail. The human eye complex. The eye of the trilobite is more complex than the human eye. It is the best optical system known in the biological world. And where do we find it? We find it in the Cambrian layer, right at the bottom, with no predecessors. I ask you, how do we get to such an advanced eye, the most complex eye in the biological world, with no predecessors? Children, what was the name of the layer? Who said that? Cambrian. You'll get a lollipop off me tomorrow. Remember the third reason that Dr. Gish gave. No change in creatures. That is a coelacanth. If you go to the British Museum of Natural History, you'll see lovely fossils of this creature, the coelacanth. They said it existed 141 years ago. However, in 1938, some fishermen fishing off the coast of Madagascar fished up a coelacanth. And in 141 million years, alleged, it hadn't changed at all. They say it was the fish that walked on land. The first land dweller. You know why? Well, if you use your imagination, you can imagine these fins turning into limbs, can't you? And it creeps out of the sea and onto land to become the first land dweller. Now, I'm not making this up. Here's a quotation from Richard Milton's book. It's an interesting book. It's called The Facts of Life. He is not a Christian. Richard Milton is a scientific journalist. But he cannot accept Darwinism. And he speaks about the exhibition of the coelacanth. The British Museum of Natural History mounted a display and parties of school children pressed their noses against the hallowed glass cabinets of South Kensington in pursuit of merit marks for approving school teachers. It soon became evident that the coelacanth was a poor choice for the missing link between marine and terrestrial life. There is, too, the awkward fact that the coelacanth lives at such depths in the oceans, 200 metres, that it explodes due to decompression when brought up to the surface. A slightly ticklish handicap for a coloniser of the land. The coelacanth does not stroll on the seabed with fins as supposed, but swims through the water just like any other fish. British Museum of Natural History, coelacanth, little label, the fish that walked on land, and hundreds of school children came around, and they didn't realise it, but their mind was being poisoned, their mind, their thinking was being coloured, the fish that walked, the fish that came out of the sea, the first land dweller. Now, some of you might be saying, but Ian, that man was measuring a fish, and it didn't explode. I think it's the swim bladder inside the fish that explodes when it comes to the surface. I'm going to move on. I don't know if you've been picking up what I'm saying, but what I'm saying is this. We've been all over the world. We've been to the sedimentary layers all over the world, and we have found a record of death. A record of death. What is the mechanism that could have caused such worldwide destruction? Australia, Brazil, Wyoming, Scotland, Germany, India, Mongolia, wherever we go in the world. If you go to Spitsbergen, an island in the middle of the Arctic Circle, coal layers and fossils. I think the Bible has the answer. I really do. Genesis chapter 6, God says, and behold, I bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. And if for no other reason, the Lord Jesus himself believed in the flood of Noah, a universal flood. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall it be. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. You know, Noah and his ark, the deluge, the flood for 40 days and 40 nights. I believe that is the mechanism that would account for so much of the fossil record that we have in the world today. How many people survived the flood? 8. And those 8 people came out and repopulated the whole earth. You and I, we have come from the 8 people on that ark. I believe that with all of my heart. I haven't got any doubt at all about it. But just imagine, the 8 people come out. Do you know, there's one thing they could not forget, the 8 people. They could never forget what they'd been through. They could never forget the silence to which they came out. The destruction of all life. An earth desecrated by the judgment of God. It is very interesting. It must have been, this is what John Urquhart says in the Testimony of Tradition to the Flood. It must have been, through generation after generation, the story must have lived on. It must have been the most awful and solemn recollection of our race. Many things may have been forgotten, but that could not be forgotten. There must have been some awful disaster that left its impress upon the minds of men. Dr. Richard Andrew, a German scholar, travelled the world, and he collected, and this is what he found. In Asia, he found 20 flood stories. In Europe, he found 5 flood stories. Africa, 7. Australia and the South Sea Islands, 10 flood stories. And in the Americas, 46 flood stories. Now, the stories vary. We have to admit that. But 3 things in common. A flood, a boat, and a few people saved. Imagine it was bedtime. You are going to put your little child to bed with a fairy story. Dad, tell me the story about a man who builds a boat to rescue some animals. So you start, well, once upon a time there was a man called Noah and he built an ark to save the animals from a flood. Dad, how big was the ark? You put on the spot, aren't you? So what you do, you pluck out of your head 3 measurements. You say it was 500 feet long, 400 feet high, and 300 feet wide. And your little boy, he's happy with that. He says, right, Dad, on you go. But a naval architect listening at the door, he's having a good old chuckle. You know why? The measurements that you've given are nonsense in terms of a vessel that would sail. The Bible gives me the dimensions of the ark. This book gives me the dimensions of the ark. 450 feet long, 45 feet high, 75 feet wide. I don't know whether you can see there is a relationship between the height and the length, 10 times, and there's a relationship between the width and the length, 6 times. It is 10 times longer than its height. It is 6 times longer than its width. What's interesting about that? The Ark was the largest ship ever built until the Cunard liner Etruria in 1884. The Great Britain, designed by Isambard Kingdom Brunel, had dimensions of 322 feet, 51 feet, 32.5 feet. Do you see the relationship with 32.5 and 322? 10 times. You see relationship between 51 and 322? 6 times. So he built the Great Britain on exactly the same proportions that were given for the ark in the Bible. Now this is interesting. The Babylonians have a flood account. And they have an ark that is 180 feet by 180 feet by 180 feet. It's a cube. It's nonsense. You would spin round like that, and they tell me you'd get awfully dizzy. Because he was in there well over a year. David Collins, himself a naval architect, he studied the Ark. He made a model of the Ark in 1977, and he tested it in 210 knot winds. 3 times hurricane force. And what did he find? He found that the Ark was more stable than modern shipping. But they made a film called In Search of Noah's Ark, Hollywood, Sun Classics, and they actually made a model of the Ark at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, La Jolla, California, and they found the simulated waves were larger than any experienced in a real ocean, and the outcome that was the Ark proved impossible to capsize. Is it just coincidence that we have in this book the dimensions of a boat that would be almost impossible to capsize? Now, some of the Christians here might have heard of a man called John Whitcomb and Henry Morris. In 1961, I think it was, they published a book called The Genesis Flood, and they really put the creationist movement on the map. Professor Morris, professor of hydrology, and he shows the calculations. I've scanned this in, but I've got it the wrong way around, but this is what he says. The Ark's dimensions made it almost impossible to capsize. Even if tilted through an angle of less than 90 degrees, the buoyant force tending to right it always acts outside the weight force tending to capsize it, thus causing it to return to its normal floating position. Even if tilted almost to 90 degrees, it would right itself. You say, Ian, I want to pick you at one of your points you made. You said that 8 people came off the Ark and set about repopulating the world. Ian, does the Bible tell us how long ago the flood happened? Well, using Bible chronology, we can say that the flood happened approximately over 4,500 years ago. So could we get the present world population from 8 people in 4,500 years? I think it's possible. Well, let's look at some figures. The lowest average population increase in Great Britain was between 1939 and 1951. You know why, don't you? It was the Second World War. And it was 0.43%. That is the lowest average population increase that we have in our country. The population of Great Britain in 1801 was 10.5 million. By 1991, according to the census, it was 54 million. That works out at an average yearly increase of 0.87%. So there we are. There's the lowest, and there's the average. Bible chronology dates the flood 4,400 years ago. It's enlightening to consider how long it would take to reach the present world population from 8 people using the minimum and the average growth rates for Great Britain. If we take the lowest growth rate from 8 people, do you know how long it would take to get the present world population? And by the way, this is from a paper published by the Creation Science Movement. It would take 4,738 years. What happens if we take the average? It would only take 2,347 years. I'm not making these facts up. They're from a paper written by a man called Paul Nichols, I think it was. Can I ask you to consider something else too? The lowest population figures for Western Europe, 0.37%. Imagine man has been on the earth for 50,000 years. Now, the evolutionist says he's been on the earth for a million plus years, Homo sapiens. But let's say he's been on the earth for 50,000 years. Do you know what the population of the world would be after 50,000 years at the lowest growth rate for Western Europe? The figure is more than the estimated number of particles in the universe. It tells me that man hasn't been on the planet for 50,000 years. Noah, says the Bible, was a preacher of righteousness. He preached for, I judge, 100 years. Preached. He told the people there was one door in the ark, and they could come through and be saved from the judgment that is coming. When I read my Bible, I find this: Noah had brothers and sisters. And his own brothers and sisters didn't listen to his preaching. And his own brothers and sisters perished in the flood. Only 8 people believed the preaching about a future coming judgment. Could I just take time tonight to say that I believe that the Lord Jesus Christ is going to return. And I believe this sinful nation of Great Britain is ripening for judgment. You, dear friend, solemn thought, you. But there is a way of escape. There is a door, just as there was a door in the ark, and the preacher of righteousness, Noah, appealed to them to come in to be saved. We tend, in the Bible story books that you see representing Noah's flood, you tend to find this. You tend to find they make a comic issue of it. And this is what Dr. John Whitcomb says. You know, he co-authored the Genesis flood. The natural forces used by God to bring about this global judgment were twofold. The fountains of the great deep were broken up. Please, it wasn't just the rain that came down from above. It was the fountains of the deep. The earth's crust was broken up. And the windows of heaven were opened. I want to say a little bit about the windows of heaven in a moment. This is what John Whitcomb says. The Bible excludes the possibility of a mere fortuitous combination of natural geologic causes here. For we are told that this involved all the fountains of the great deep, and that they were all broken up on the same day. The 17th day of the second month. This uplift of ocean basins, accompanied by enormous explosions, suboceanic and subterranean magmas and steam, together with the corresponding sinking of continents, continued for 6 weeks until the flood attained its maximum mountain-covering depth, and this depth was maintained for another 110 days until the waters had destroyed every living thing from the continents. Noah was in the ark for over a year. And when the waters subsided, and he came to lodge on Mount Ararat, as the Bible would say, he came out to look on a world that had been devastated under the hand of God's judgment. You might be saying, Ian, couldn't rain for 40 days and 40 nights. It never happens today. Admit that, it couldn't rain today for 40 days and 40 nights. I'll tell you what the key is. If I go back here, here's the key to it all. I used to find it very hard to read Genesis 1 and understand it, but Genesis 1, there was darkness upon the face of the deep. The whole earth was covered by water, no land visible at all. But then in verse 6, God said, let there be a firmament, a space in the midst of the waters, and let divide the waters from the waters. On the second day of creation, God took some of the water from the water-covered globe and placed it high above the earth in what they call the vapor canopy. This is what many of the creationists believe, that what happened on day 2 of creation is the key to it all. It is that that came down in the 40 days and 40 nights. It is that which came down and gave the deluge. Now, I got to press on. I've got 4 minutes and I'm going to just wind it up ever so slowly. There we are. Do you like Chinese takeaways? That's 2,000 years old. And I've checked this out. I've met a Chinese gentleman recently and I've tried it out on him. It's made up of three parts. It means, that pictogram there means a large ship. What does the first symbol mean? Just means a boat. What about the second symbol? It means eight. What about the third symbol? It means mouth. When the Chinese talk of people, they use an expression which literally means man-mouth. We count heads, they count mouths. So the symbol, by coincidence, is it? For a large ship means a boat with eight people in it? Because what does the Bible say? When the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was preparing, wherein few, that is eight souls, were saved through water. Now, perhaps there are some Christians sitting there, and you think that it was just a local flood. Can I give you my reasons for believing that it was a universal flood? I'll give you seven reasons. If the flood was local, why did Noah have to build an ark at all? He could have walked to the other side of the mountains and missed it. Secondly, if the flood was local, why did God send the animals to the ark so they would escape death? There would have been other animals to reproduce that kind if these particular ones had died. He didn't need to take them into the ark. He could have taken them to a remote part of the landscape that wouldn't be inundated by the flood. If the flood was local, why was the ark big enough to hold all kinds of land, vertebrate animals that have ever existed? Henry Morris actually does the calculations to show this. If only Mesopotamian animals were on board, the ark could have been much smaller. And then, if the flood was local, why did birds have to come on board? Because birds could just fly away, couldn't they? Winged it to a nearby mountain range. If the flood was local, how could the waters rise to 15 cubits above the mountains? Water seeks its own level. Now, the highest mountain in Scotland, Ben Nevis. Just imagine it was 10 feet. The water level was 10 feet above Ben Nevis. Would it only be Scotland that was covered? Don't you see that water seeks out its own level, and it would be that height the whole world over? You'd have a universal flood. Then sixthly, if the flood was local, people who did not happen to be living in the vicinity would not be affected by it. They would have escaped God's judgment and sin. If this happened, what did Christ mean when he likened the coming of judgment of all men to the judgment of all men in Matthew 24 in the days of Noah? A partial judgment in Noah's day means a partial judgment to come. And the last reason is this. If the flood was local, God would have repeatedly broken his promise never to send such a flood again. Because he promised he'd never send. We've had loads of local floods since then. It cannot be a local flood. It has to be a universal flood. Last slide. Permit me. The last slide. I think it's the most important slide. I'm going to show you the door. That's the door to safety. It really is the door to safety. Jesus Christ said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. Who is he? He is the creator of all things, as we said on Monday night. Created all things. And he is the one who wants to be the doorway for you into security. Security that God offers through faith. Because he's going to punish you for your sin one day. But he doesn't want to do that. He wants you to escape, and he wants you to come in through the door. It was my blessed experience in 1973 to come in through the door. I gave my life to the man who died for me. And I've come to find this out. This book can be relied upon. This book has the key. And indeed, the first 11 chapters of the Bible, the chapters that come under attack most of all, are the chapters that we need to put our all upon. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'm just going to finish there. And there's a cup of tea afterwards. Could we have some lights, Raymond? I've just been asked to give a short word of thanks for the refreshments that we're going to receive. So, shall we pray? We give thanks, our God, for the time that we've had tonight to be able to consider these solemn truths, the judgment of God upon this world in a day gone by. Help us to think seriously upon these things and upon the Lord Jesus, who himself is the door to safety. We give thanks for the refreshments in the Saviour's precious name.